The obvious first question for me is about your time as a spy. And the question I have for you is, did you ever have to honeypot someone?
No. It was the dullest time that I ever had in my life as a spy, because I was in Japan and we expected all kinds of nonsense to happen. And nothing happened because the emperor said the war was over.
Welcome to the Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
Welcome back to Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian. I'm your host, Preet Banerjee, and on the show today, I have a very special guest. I'll be talking to an absolute titan in the Canadian financial services, Stephen Jarislowsky. For the five people on the planet who don't know who Stephen is, we'll get into that during our chat. But just as a prelude, here is the list of universities who have bestowed him with honorary doctors of law degrees. Queen's University, University of Alberta, Université de Montréal, McMaster, Concordia, Assumption University, Laval, University of Ottawa, Simon Fraser University, McGill, and l'Université du Québec. It would take me 20 minutes just to read his complete bio. And as usual, before I introduce Stephen officially, thank you again to all the listeners who've left star ratings on iTunes. A special thanks this week to PP Gangster from Montreal, who started listening to the podcast only a few months ago, but has caught up on the now 4 years of content. Of course, my faithful listeners know that I don't have a set schedule for publishing, much as I try. So 4 years of content isn't that big of a deal. But in all seriousness, thank you so much for listening. And if you haven't done so yet, I really do appreciate you taking 5 seconds to leave a rating on iTunes. And if you want to take the additional time to write in a comment on top of that, I do read them all. And now, on to today's guest, who I'm incredibly excited to chat with. And where to begin? Stephen Jarislowsky was born in Berlin in 1925. He attended schools in the Netherlands and France before immigrating to the U.S. in 1941. He studied mechanical engineering at Cornell, served in the U.S. Army, studied Japanese at the University of Chicago, and became a counterintelligence agent serving in Japan after the war. Then thought, might as well get an MBA from, Harvard, and a few years later started the now famous firm Jarislowsky Fraser Limited in June of 1955 in Montreal. He guided the firm for 60 years and is now chairman emeritus. Assets under management at Jarislowsky Fraser are north of $40 billion, and he himself is listed by Forbes as a billionaire. He's a member of the Canadian Business Hall of Fame, co-founder and director of the Canadian Coalition for Good Governance, and a renowned philanthropist, having endowed over 20 university research chairs and made cultural donations such as the Stephen A. Jarislowsky Dance Studio in Vancouver and the Gail and Stephen A. Jarislowsky Institute for Studies in Canadian Art, and more. And again, there is so much more I could tell you about Stephen, but I want to take up the entire podcast just telling you about him. Let's actually talk to the man himself. So, Stephen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Normally, I have my picture taken at the same time, but here I will just have to do with my voice, I understand.
I mean, I have my iPhone. I could take a picture if you like. Now, I have so many questions about so many different parts of your life. But the obvious first question for me is about your time as a spy. And the question I have for you is, did you ever have to honeypot someone?
No, it was the dullest time that I ever had in my life as a spy, because I was in Japan and we expected all kinds of nonsense to happen. And nothing happened because the emperor said the war was over. And the Japanese, being a very structured type of country and probably the most Confucian, that's the Chinese sage, nation in the world. The moment the war was over, there was no animosity. Everything worked fine. And I spoke Japanese, so I was idolated by them. They thought it was absolutely unbelievable that there was somebody who spoke Japanese, and the son of the Prime Minister Yoshida at the time came over to my barracks for us to discuss philosophy and wow. things like that. So I had a wonderful time. And it also was the time in which I got the highest medal that I've ever gotten in my life. And it was from the Japanese government, not from the American.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And is that in this, I mean, this office, we're sitting in Stephen's office in Montreal, and it's decorated with some beautiful art. There's tons of awards. You've run out of space. But where do you keep, do you have like a separate house where you keep all your awards or something?
No. I don't even know where they are anymore. I'm now old enough to forget that they're probably in some boxes in the basement or something.
But, you know what's funny is... But
I will have to tell you about this medal I got.
Yeah, please.
Because one night I was stupid enough to be in my barracks, and there was a fight between black marketeers, Formosan, that's the same as Taiwan, and also Korean. And they had guns, and they were shooting at each other near the Diet Building in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And I was stupid enough to be the only officer, so I had to take 4 squads to break up this fight. And it was after the war. There was no sense of getting killed.
Right.
So I took these 48 guys, and I saw these guys were shooting at each other. Mm-hmm. So I decided not to go in the middle of them.
Smart.
And we waited till it got dark a bit, and they ran out of ammunition. And by coincidence, we took the ringleaders of one of the faction as prisoners.
Wow.
We didn't have any casualties, of course.
Yeah.
And I drove them. Sitting like a Texan Ranger on the rear wheel of my Jeep, I drove them to the police station. I didn't know who they were, but they were these big shots. Yeah. And so I got the Order of the Chrysanthemum from the Japanese government.
Wow, that's phenomenal. And what's really interesting about that story is the patience involved. You waited for them to run out of ammunition.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the hallmarks of your investing style as well, is you're incredibly disciplined and patient.
I am very patient.
Right. And the other thing I want to mention just before we get into the meat of this podcast is I love how coolly and quickly you answered my question about the honeypot, because I think a lot of people don't actually know what the honeypot technique is. But you, being a former spy, know exactly what it is. Can you just tell our listeners what it is?
I won't go into it, but what you do, what you really do as a spy, you find out who the other spies from the other side are,
yeah.
And then you trade stories to each other so that you both get recognized by your government.
There you have it. Okay, so I should also point out that Monsieur Robert Pouliot is in the office with us, and the three of us know each other through FAIR Canada, which is the Foundation for the Advancement of Investor Rights. So we're all directors there. And Stephen is really FAIR Canada himself. I mean, FAIR Canada, you are the main benefactor. You've connected us with a lot of people. And we're going to touch upon some of the things that we as an organization want people to know in this podcast. And we're going to do that by talking a little bit about your history first. And then we'll talk specifically about, you know, things investors should be looking out for.
Okay.
So I want to start with the inception of Jarislowsky Fraser Limited. So this was in Montreal, June of 1955, I believe. And what was the reason that you started up this firm in the first place? I mean, you had jumped from different types of careers, mechanical engineering, you studied Japanese. I mean, again, I could spend hours just talking to you about things that happened before that. But let's talk about the inception of Jarislowsky Fraser.
Well, there was a very good reason for it, because mm-hmm. I only wanted to work till age 40. And at the time, I was about, in 1952, I was 27. No, how old was I in 52? I was born in 25.
27.
20, yeah, something like that. And so I wanted to basically become the American ambassador to Japan, because I had been with the American forces at age 40, but I needed about $1 million. And so my aim was to make $1 million between that time and my 40th birthday, mm-hmm. so that I could duly be appointed ambassador.
Right.
You see?
So and that was the real motivation.
That was the real motivation. Now, don't forget, so that $1 million in those days is probably
a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. I mean, that's not $1 million today. I mean, you must be able to multiply that by 20 or more. Mm-hmm. So I had a big job ahead of myself.
Right. Okay, so you start the firm, and you've guided that firm for 60 years. You're chairman
62.
Emeritus.
62. I have to correct you.
Oh, I apologize. Yes, 62 years. So one question I have. So you're kind of known as Canada's Warren Buffett, value investor, don't make a lot of transactions. And in fact, you only started using email 4 years ago. You know, you're very old school. So are there any stocks that you own today that you bought back in the
50s? Yes, I own some of them, which really? I owned. Because when I was at the Harvard Business School, and my major was in finance, even though I was a mechanical engineer by training. Mm-hmm. But I felt that finance, as I said to you before, was very important for my ambition
right.
to become the ambassador to Japan. Right? So, well, I bought United Airlines, which went up and down like a yo-yo.
Yeah.
And finally, I was able to sell it at 20 times what I paid for it. But of course, that was many years later.
Right.
And the inflation had made the price higher.
And did you sell it before they started to beat up all their passengers?
No. Well before.
Okay, good.
I sold it probably about 30 years ago because there was a period when it went to $300.
Wow.
And then I sold it, and it has never seen that price since. But that was sheer luck.
Right.
But then also I bought Exxon, and I bought Abbott Laboratories when I was at the Harvard Business School.
Okay. So that would have been in the late 40s?
That was in 48 and 49.
Wow. And so you still hold that?
I still own both of them.
And I bet you've done very well.
And the Abbott I bought today, if you look at it, for pennies.
Right.
And I think it sells at $45, and it has broken into two companies. ABBV is one of them.
It's probably had a number of splits over time.
That's what
well.
I'm talking about. Yeah. Many, many splits. And the company also was split into two companies, mm-hmm. and the other company sells it around 60-something dollars, 64, I believe. Mm-hmm. So the split stock is today $100, and I bought it for pennies before the splits.
Right. So you have this history of buying stocks and holding them for a long time.
Yeah.
The turnover in your portfolios
are
very small.
Because I don't want to pay any money to the government I don't have to pay. And I pay an enormous amount to the government, and I get very little for it from the government.
So if you sell the firm, you're going to have to realize a large capital gain. Could you say, hey, listen, now I want my ambassadorship?
It's too late. It's too late. And I've never appointed an ambassador yet at the age of 91, you know.
Right. Yes, and you are, 91 years old.
That's correct.
Another accomplishment in and of itself.
That's correct.
You're one of the sharpest guys. We've been in a lot of meetings, and you are one of the sharpest guys at 91, let alone at 40, that I've ever spoken to. Like, your memory is unbelievable, like a steel trap.
Well, I have to interrupt you because my wife thinks that I've become a four-year-old again.
Oh, really? okay, well, maybe she sees a different side of you, I guess, than we do. But
she says all men remain children.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah,
I can totally see that. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the investment style that you have.
Now I have to become serious, right?
Well, you don't have to.
Well, I firmly believe that, and I gave this as a talk when I got my honorary degree from the University of British Columbia. Mm-hmm. I said there were three important things that the students had to remember. And you know, when they graduate, they don't listen to you.
Right.
I graduated from three universities. And I don't remember a thing what the person who was honored said. So I tried to do my very best to impress them.
Yeah.
And I said, the first thing is in this world, you have to learn how to think. And the reason history is as terrible as it has been is because always the majority of people never learn how to think. Mm-hmm. They want to be gratified the same day. There's a marshmallow test where you put a kid in four years old in the room, and you put one marshmallow in front of him, and the mother goes out and says, I'll be back in 20 minutes. And if you haven't eaten that marshmallow, you get another one. And most of the people eat the marshmallow in those 20 minutes mm-hmm. because they didn't have a secure type of disciplined life up to the age of four. That's the reason. They were badly treated by their parents, and I blame the parents for that. Now, I obviously brought my kids up to a correct way. I mean, you wouldn't doubt that for a second.
So if I brought your kids in here right now and put a marshmallow in front of them, they wouldn't eat it.
They wouldn't eat. They would wait for 20 minutes.
Right. Okay, but, so that's number one. People have to think for
themselves. What I'm trying to say, you have to think for yourself.
Yeah.
And nobody can think for you. And nobody can understand the result of your thinking. You have to understand yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was at Chicago, they wanted me to stay there and teach comparative religion of all the Buddhists and Hindu sects and God knows what of the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to go there because I wrote an essay to myself on understanding. And at the end of my essay, I said, when you understand something, then you have to do something about it.
Right.
Not just teach, right?
Right.
So I decided to go into business and went to the Harvard Business School.
Right.
But so, first of all, most people don't think. But if you think, then you can become a good investor. Because mm-hmm. by being able to think, you can see things on a long-term basis rather than asking. And that's why I told you about the marshmallow test,
right.
About the instant gratification. On the topic of the marshmallow test again, they looked at the same kids 30 years later, and the difference in the careers was absolutely amazing.
Right.
I mean, one was working at manual labor, and the other one was a lawyer or something like that.
Yeah, I remember reading a lot about the follow-up studies on those kids and what happened to them as adults. Their rate of marriage breakdown was lower for the people who could resist. Their incomes were higher.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of characteristics that were just markedly different. So,
exactly.
All right. So that's rule number one, which is you have to think for yourself.
Yes, you have to think. And then you have to do something with it.
And you have to do something. Yeah.
Right. And then you have to maybe force yourself to do, because otherwise, what's the thinking worth? It's not worth anything.
Right.
What's the understanding worth if you don't do anything with it? So you have a long-term approach. And I said to those students at UBC, I said, you're, say, in the early 20s, and if you put $10,000 away and you operate and get the same return, which our firm has gotten for private accounts, which is 9% per year, and of that, of course, we take a fee, and the tax department takes the tax on the dividend, but not on the capital gain if you don't sell,
mm-hmm.
correct?
If you don't sell.
If you don't sell, and therefore you have to look at things that you don't need to sell. Don't buy the United Airlines, which you would have to sell up and down many times. If you bought the Abbott and the Exxon, you didn't have to sell,
mm-hmm.
right? So all that money stays working for you. And oddly enough, it also works for the government at the same time. So you're actually doing the government this favor. Mm-hmm. But if you start at 20 and you double your money every year, at 30, you're going to have $20,000 out of the 10, right?
Mm-hmm.
At 40, it's going to be 40. At 50, it's going to be 80. At 60, it's going to be 120. And at 70, it's going to be 240. Et cetera, et cetera. So by the time you're 90 years old, you hardly needed to save anything except that $10,000 to have a fine retirement.
Right. And that's just an initial lump sum investment. If you kept on chipping away and
if you did
money-
that every year, just imagine the amount of money you would have at the end of it.
Right. Now, maybe a couple billion dollars like yourself.
I was a very lucky fellow because I inherited from my father, who mm-hmm. had died when I was 4, I inherited $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time I touched at it was when I was in New York and working for my wife's family for 2 years before I sold it. And that's the only money I took out of that $100,000 because my first wife didn't want to pay me.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that you married me for better or worse and to support the family. And the estate wasn't settled, so we couldn't get at the money anyhow for a while, right? But other than that, I never took any money out of it.
So that money is still invested?
That money is still invested in one of my holding companies, and it's worth $75 million now.
Wow.
right?
So when you got that at 4, so that's 87?
No, I didn't get it at 4. I got it at 21.
Oh, you got it at 20. Okay.
They don't leave people money to spend at 4 years of age.
I think you could have been the only 4-year-old who could have handled it.
No. Absolutely not. I might even have eaten a marshmallow at the time.
Yeah, so you got it at 21 and you're 91 now. So 70 years. The bulk of that money is not touched and is now worth $75 million.
There would have
bucks.
Been seven doubles.
Yeah.
Right? Seven doubles. And if I doubled my money in the next 10 years, assuming that I lived to 101, right?
Yeah.
I would double everything I have today.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
So here's a question.
I mean, that's even getting better paid than the best executive in the world who's overpaid and who gets 400 times his average worker's pay.
Oh, yes. So here's my question to you. There have been a number of studies that have cited statistics like when it comes to transferring wealth from one generation to the next, especially when it comes to high net worth families, within 2 or 3 generations, the money is gone because they don't have the same principles or knowledge, or they don't care about the money as much. So what have you done to ensure that when your children receive your wealth, that they will carry on being good stewards of that capital like you were?
Well, I had a wonderful, first of all, in my family, my father's philosophy was that you give 10% of what you earn to charity, you live on 10%, and the rest you reinvest. That's not easy to do.
No, I would say for the average Canadian, they're not going to be able to invest 80% of their paycheck.
And the other good thing I did is I was born just before the Depression in 1925. It first was the big boom, but I didn't know about it because I was 4 years old.
You're just thinking about marshmallows.
In 1929. But when I grew up in my early life, in my teens, that was during the Depression.
So that formed the way you looked at the world.
That's correct.
Yeah. And this is something I've noticed as well. People.
And then in the army, I learned discipline. You know, I had to do exactly what the sergeant said when I was trained. I mean, the training was so bad that the guys in my outfit wanted to go to the front because they thought that was easier.
Jeez.
I knew better because I'd lived in France during the defeat of the French.
Right.
Of the French nation by the Germans.
Wow.
Right? So I knew what fighting was all about and what strafing by aircraft when you're on the roads as a young kid was all about. So discipline was not something that I had any problem with.
Right. And like I said, there's so many things that I would love to talk to you about. I mean, we could do a series of about 10 podcasts here because talking about, you know, the Nazis in France, if I'm not mistaken, I read somewhere that your stepfather was accused of harboring Jews during that time period. I mean, we could talk about.
No, he actually worked with an American who was a Quaker in Marseille. Mm-hmm. And books have been written about this Quaker. Because he ferreted Adam scientists and the cousin of the King of Belgium out of the occupied France. Mm-hmm. And then when my father got a call from the French government to go and to New York to be economic attaché to the Vichy French government in New York, that's when we left.
Wow. Yeah, like I said, so many things that I would love to talk to you about, but really this episode is about...
But I want to come back to the stocks.
Yes.
Because what I'm trying to say is that you should leave your money in, try to go into stocks, which you don't have to sell for many, many years. And if each year they increase the earnings by about 8-9% and it raise the dividend by about that kind of money... Well, you're made. Mm-hmm. And if you leave a certain amount of cash on the side, because every once in a while the market goes down 20-30%, and you then used that cash on which you got nothing while it was cash, but if you buy 20 or 30 or 40% cheaper, you made 40% on that money, really.
So let's talk about that, because that's one of the areas where investors have a hard time, and that is staying the course when times are tough. So having been a professional investor since the 50s and starting investing before that, before you started JFL, what are the scariest times that you've seen when it comes to the stock market?
Well, the scariest time probably was when in 2009 and 2008, the whole financial setup of the free world could have gone down in flames. Mm-hmm. When there was a real panic going on and Lehman Brothers went bankrupt and every bank in New York and in all over the world, if there had been a run on that bank, it would have been one run after another of banks all around the world. And what were you going to do then, right? Mm-hmm. Anyhow, it didn't happen, thank God, because they printed money, and money has always been printed. And they guaranteed all the bank accounts, because that's the only way to stop everybody running on the bank.
Right.
Right? It didn't happen. And that, of course, was the biggest opportunity of quasi my lifetime after the age of 21 to buy stocks.
Right.
Well, I didn't buy enough because I was a bit concerned myself that some of these other financials would go down. But that kind of a panic, and no panic lasts for a long time. That is the ideal time to buy excellent securities at a cheap price.
Yeah, you know, the way I look at it is I see a lot of people and they get nervous when markets are down. And because they don't understand it, they haven't studied market history, they don't really know much about investing. When you don't know, you get scared.
But it's worse than that.
Well, let me finish my point. So what I say is, well, think about other things in life that you buy. So imagine you're walking to work every day and every day you pass by a store and there's a pair of shoes that you like and they're, I don't know, $100. And then one day you walk by that store and it's $50. Are you going to freak out and say, oh no, there must be something wrong, I shouldn't buy those shoes? Or are you going to buy a pair, maybe even two, right? You would load up, you would take advantage of that sale because
true.
You
that's
understand
true.
It.
That's true.
And I see stocks and investments for the long term the same way, especially for younger people. If there's a big downturn, you should be wringing your hands in delight thinking, you know what? I get to buy future retirement income at a discount.
Absolutely. But you have to be careful because if the company goes broke, it's not like that shoe.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm an indexer. So I know you're an active manager, you're a value investor, but a form of investing that's become very popular has been passive investing.
Yeah.
So as a legendary active investor, what's your take on passive investing for the average investor out there?
Well, I think for the average investor, it's certainly better than being talking to a broker who sells you a new moose pasture every 6 months, and he always has a better stock, and he always sells your stock when it has gone up a bit to make up for all the losses he produces, till you finally decide that this is a mug's game and that you're wasting your money and that you shouldn't invest that way.
Right.
But as far as I'm concerned, I like to be in the kind of stocks with excellent management. That's the first thing I look at. Then it has to be a growing industry, and it has to be an industry that's going to be here 50 years from now because I don't want to pay capital gains tax.
Right. Okay, so what are your rules for investors out there? So for people who are listening and they say, all right, you know, talking to someone who's been a successful investor for 7+ decades, What are the key takeaways that they need to know if they want to be successful investors?
Well, I think they have to look at the industry and ask, is it going to be like, say, the newspapers or the automobile of the first years, where company after company went bankrupt, even though the automobile was a wonderful invention, mm-hmm. and only 3 or 4 companies eventually survived.
Right.
Don't speculate. Buy things that are top quality, that have the deep moats for anybody to invade them, and have excellent management.
Let's talk about moats, because I think a lot of people may not be familiar with the idea of economic moats. Mm. So what is a moat? When people say you want to look for a business that has a big moat, what does that mean?
Well, if you're a company like Coca-Cola, and you practically control the market, you know, then it's very difficult for anybody to build a company of that size. Mm-hmm. If you're like the Canadian banks, which are oligopolies, the nearest thing to a monopoly, and earn more money every year and pay a higher dividend every year, that's a kind of stock that I also like, you know? Canadian banks were so rich, they didn't get affected by the big break in 2008, 2009. They sailed right through it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what about asset allocation? So, for example, you know, if you've decided, yes, I'm going to be a value investor, I'm going to buy high-quality companies, people will have a bit of a home bias because they'll buy what they know, and most of what they see will be in the country that they live in. So what do you feel about, you know, diversification to asset classes around the world, like stocks in the U.S. versus Europe and whatnot? How does someone approach that? What's your philosophy on that?
Well, my philosophy is very simple. I try to buy companies in industries which are not going to be obsolete. Now, I don't think drinking beer, they're not going to make those beer breweries obsolete.
Not if I have anything to say about it.
No, liquor the same type of thing. Toilet paper is probably here to stay for a certain amount of
time. Well, it depends on where you live in the world. Some people don't use toilet paper.
That's true. and they're going to get new machines like the Japanese, which will spray you clean.
Oh, they'll wipe your ass for you, yeah.
That's right.
Exactly. I don't know how I feel about that. You hit a button and a little hand comes and it's like, whose hand is that?
That's right. Exactly. You might even become suspicious of the machine.
What were Japanese toilets like back in the day? Because I know today they're super high tech. They've got like little streams of water. They've got puffs of air. There's perfume.
They even dry it afterwards.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. You know, we're slumming it here in North America.
That's correct. But it's this kind of industries which survive for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cosmetics will always be there. That's another industry. And if you have a very leading cosmetic industry, you don't care whether it's incorporated in the United States or in France, and I'm thinking of two specific companies, and because they're both going to do well as long as they have excellent management.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that really can kill them is poor management that doesn't hire the right people, the right innovators, etc., etc. So you look for that kind of stocks which you don't have to sell. And the beauty of some of those large companies is, like in Procter & Gamble, for a great number of years now, it hasn't done that well. Neither has Coca-Cola, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm.
But somebody will come in there. If the management doesn't, somebody will come in there, put good management in, and it will go out in another direction. Some of the printing companies are doing well today, but they're not in printing anymore.
Right.
Their management was so excellent that they could also tackle another industry about which they knew a certain amount of things and make that database for the next thing. And then they would buy up a number of companies. There's a company here in Montreal that's been doing that, and that's doing just fine.
Mm-hmm.
They were in printing of newspapers and flyers and had all these little regional newspapers. So now they went into packaging. There's another company in the States that was in envelopes, you know, envelopes. People don't write letters anymore. All they do is email.
Right.
So the envelopes were going to hell. They were becoming obsolete. Well, they went into some computer direction, and they're doing fabulous. So excellent management is always what you look at. Don't buy a cheap stock, which is cheap because of bad management, unless you know that some better management is going to go in there. But then you still have time till you can find out whether that better management is good or whether they're just another bunch of bums.
So I think this is a good segue to talk about your interest in corporate governance, because, you know, with management, part of having good management and having good governance is having the feedback mechanisms to help you know, all right, something needs to be done and we need to change direction and whatnot, as opposed to just hiring someone and say, all right, see what you can do. There's got to be some kind of framework there. And so you've been a board of director or a director on something like 30 plus boards of big companies in your time. And of course, you're a director of Fair Canada, and you also were a co-founder for an organization that specifically tackles good governance. So what?
Actually, three of them.
Three of them.
Because FAIR is that type of an operation.
Yeah.
FAIR is trying to bring good governance and ethical dealings into the industry and an understanding by people who know how to think, because the ones that eat up the marshmallow right away, I mean, you can't really appeal to those.
Right.
But to the ones who wait and who are thoughtful and have brains, we are trying to protect them. Mm-hmm. Right? And we're trying to teach them what they should do and what they shouldn't do.
And one of the things that you're, a phrase that you use, and it was the title of your book, The Investment Zoo. Right. What do you mean by the investment zoo? What is the investment
zoo? It has a double meaning. Mm-hmm. First of all, people talk about the stock, about stocks, and stocks are dangerous. But there are all kinds of animals, just like in a zoo. And some aren't dangerous at all. Mm-hmm. Some might even protect you, like dogs, right?
Yeah.
And but some might attack you, and there are lots of those around too.
Right.
And on the other hand, it is a zoo because the rules are so lousy that you have to really be on your guard in the sense of a zoo, mm-hmm. entirely unpredictable as to what is going to happen. So I took the double meaning of the word for the title of the book.
Right. So how do you manage navigating the zoo then as an investor? Because you've got, I would say there are some people with misaligned incentives, and you as an individual, you want to increase your wealth, make sure that you're financially secure. And so who are all these different animals? No, not just the different types of stocks, but in terms of the jungle and the zoo, what are the things you have to look out for as an individual financial consumer?
Well, you have to look out for companies like Valiant and not, or Nortel, and not get stuck in them. You have to be very careful of anybody who has a conflict of interest from yours. Don't have a broker who lives on commissions as an advisor, mm-hmm. because he's going to, when his boss asks him, how have you been doing? He doesn't want to know how his clients has been doing.
Right.
They did. They want to know how much commissions he brought in,
yeah,
right?
That's true. Okay. I remember back in my days, so I was a broker, and the metrics, they very rarely talk, well, how have you been doing for your clients? It has so been, how are you growing your book and all
what
that
I
stuff.
Always thought of myself as is a rabbit in the middle of a meadow in the woods. Mm-hmm. And there were all kinds of creatures among the trees, right, who all tried to get my money. So you have to be very careful. Mm-hmm. Don't believe. Don't be gullible. Don't try to get rich. Try to get the kind of stocks which you can keep for a long, long time, which brokers hate, because how are they going to make commissions?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, because clearly there are bad actors, but then there are people who are sort of like the white hats. They're doing good things, and there are certainly advisors out there who are worth paying for and having that advisor relationship. So how do you tease apart the good from the bad? What's your advice for people on how to judge, you know, if you're getting good advice?
Well, first of all, you go back to what we said before. If the guy is emotional, I don't want him as my investment manager, mm-hmm. right? He may be an investment manager, but as far as I'm concerned, he's dangerous. If he doesn't can't think and understand things, and realize what good management and what bad management is, I don't want them either, right? Mm-hmm. That's how it works. In other words, I want thinking human beings who are grown-up people, who have lots of imagination, who are interested to learn things all their life, who dig into things to the point of getting all the information, then doing the thinking, and then try to reach an understanding, and then still check that understanding. In other words, when we started in business, we never bought a stock unless we visited the company for 3 years in a row.
Wow. Now that's some due diligence that I don't think a lot of individual investors would do.
And at that time, we knew, people might have told us that's good management, but at that time, because we visited the whole industry, mm-hmm. we knew all the players in the industry.
Right.
And we asked them who they modeled themselves after. Mm-hmm. And then we talked to the people they modeled themselves after, etc.
Right.
And then we tried to find out what the company was doing and how it was doing that, and to what extent were the people who worked there proud of the company, because it was a company that didn't just try to make money, but that tried to do good work for people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're a firm that has never been to law with a single client in 62 years, and which never in 62 years has had anybody complain to a securities commission.
That is a phenomenal record.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, okay, so let me ask you about the current environment when it comes to managers, people in the industry right now. So you're very specific. You have a very specific style. You're a buy and hold value investor. Don't make a lot of transactions. But there are a lot of different styles out there. And now with the advent of computers and algorithmic trading, high frequency trading, is it getting harder for the average active manager to deliver value to their clients?
I think so, because the average manager also operates on his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
He buys things when everything is perfect. Well, everything doesn't stay perfect, right? So Aristotle said that the mean was opposed to both extremes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So you don't want to be overly emotional, but you don't want to be totally without sex, right?
Definitely not.
So you want to still be interested and fascinated by things and not just go on a machine basis.
Right.
Because management is very difficult to measure. And I don't think a machine will ever really measure management of a corporation. It's a question of having the right people in the right spots, and people who are thinking, people with imagination, and people who verify things, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It's quite complex, and you have to get that kind of a culture. And even if you have that kind of a culture, you have no assurance that if the CEO dies, that the next guy is not going to make a mistake.
Right.
So you still have to go back into it again to find out whether that new management, that new executive who has been hired, is going to continue policies that you can live with.
So here's a question, and we're friends here, so I don't need to be too delicate, but you're 91, right? And there are a lot of investors with JFL. So what assurances have you put in place where you can give to your clients to make sure that your style continues after you're gone?
Well, the only thing I can say is that all the people here have operated on that style during the whole period they have been here. Now, I don't know what's going to happen after my death. You know, I think it was one of the Louis kings of France who said, "Après moi le déluge, after me flood." You know, you better build your Noah ark,
yeah,
and bring all the animals in, right? So. You can never know everything in this world.
Yeah. But your portfolio managers, they've been with you a long time, so it's the same style, right?
It's
so it's the same
style.
Same question people have about Buffett, right? And Berkshire Hathaway. What happens after Buffett?
Well,
but they've got a contingency plan.
There's no total insurance in this world, you know. I mean, that just doesn't exist.
Right.
So whatever you do, there's a degree of risk. The question is, how high is the degree of risk?
Yeah.
Not the fact that there is a degree of risk. There is a degree of risk. There's a degree of risk every morning that you drive to work. Somebody might bump into you, might not even be your fault.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to end by talking a little bit about risk, because I think a lot of people focus too much on the return and they don't put enough emphasis on studying the risk. And I think this is particularly important going forward because I forget who it was, Merton or Miller, who said that the cost of capital is the investor's expected return. Well, if you look at the cost of capital right now in this low interest rate environment, it's very low. So the expected return going forward, based on that, would be expected to be lower than it has been in the last 70 years. But there's still going to be a lot of risk, right? And so when people focus on these returns from the past and they want to see these returns, in order to get that, they might have to take more risk. or they haven't even looked at what risk really looks like. So what is your advice to people when it comes to the turbulence that they will experience going forward? Do you sit down with an advisor? Do you do your own research and figure out how much fixed income or other diversifying asset classes you put into your portfolio? How do you manage the risk as opposed to the return? How do you manage the risk?
I always, in every account, have cash. Mm-hmm. Every individual account of mine has cash. And it has at least 10% cash. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when the market is high and the dividends come in, I leave the dividends accumulate because I don't want to buy in those high stock markets, right? But eventually, unless the client wants to take the dividends out and spend that money, if he gives it to me on the basis of doubling the money every 10 years, in which case he shouldn't take that money out, mm-hmm. I can do that. But the risk I'm going to take is the one that I'm going to have sufficient cash so that in bad times I have money to buy.
Right.
When the guy is scared shitless, right? Yeah. At that time, if he listens to me, I will buy for him and he will think I'm absolutely crazy because he already has lost half his money and he can't afford to lose the other half, right?
Right. But that's the time to buy.
But that's definitely the time to buy. So you don't buy at that bottom because he will fire you the next day because the chances of the market will still go down, right?
Right.
Unless he's been with you for 60 years. Then he's used to it.
Right.
In 2009, when the market hit its lowest point, I was in my office every day. I didn't even go on vacation in those times. And I expected that people would call me, but they didn't call me. My old clients didn't call me.
Right.
The only ones who called me were the new clients.
Right. You hadn't trained them yet.
The old clients, I asked them, why aren't you calling me? I called them up. They said, well, if you don't know, what am I going to do, right? So why bother you under the circumstances?
Right.
I don't buy bonds. I don't buy long-term bonds. I buy cash or cash equivalent, okay? Because after inflation and after income tax, you don't make any progress.
Right.
You may be able to, if you get 4% and 2% is inflation and 2% is tax, you got nothing, right?
Yeah. So if I could sum up your...
And then let me just finish.
Sure, yeah, please.
You're interrupting me.
I'm sorry, Stephen.
Because when I look at the charts of the stock market ever since, say, 1850, it's always up. And it's even up at the 5, 6, 7% average rate most of the time, right? That's a hell of a lot more than in that bond money.
Yeah.
And therefore, if I buy the ETF, at least I will get the return of the market.
Right. Again, if I could sum up your investing wisdom to pass on to the masses, it's incredibly simple but very effective.
It's very simple.
Buy and hold. Do a little bit of research. Think for yourself. Don't use emotions. Keep your costs low. Don't pay taxes if you don't have to. Yeah. Hold for a very long time. I mean, this is all really fundamental stuff. Yeah. It's easy, but it's not simple for people to execute. But I think that is a testament to...
Now, I told you the two things I told these students at the University of British Columbia.
Yeah.
Now, what was the third one? Well, the third one is if you live an ethical life, you don't even need religion because... Religion is, ethics is the basis of all religions. Now, they don't have purgatory anymore in the Catholic Church. But when I want to take a flight from here to Vancouver, from here to Washington, I like a direct flight better than if I have to stop in Toronto and transfer, right?
Are you calling Toronto purgatory?
I don't like Toronto, but that's my bias. Some people like Toronto, you know. Thank God that most of the people live in Toronto. They don't live where I like to live, right?
Stephen, I live in Toronto. I'm so hurt.
Well, you shouldn't be hurt because you're coming to Montreal and visit me.
And it is my pleasure to do so. Sorry, did you want to, do you have more to say on that point number three?
I have more to say there. And to the extent that I was able to do something, I tried in the investment world to set up things like FAIR or like the Institute for Government of Private and Public Institutions in Quebec, mm-hmm. or the Canadian Coalition for Good Governance, which is an assembly of all the big institutional managers in Canada. Between us, our members manage over $3 trillion today. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to look at all kinds of issues in order to see what are the ethical solutions that would make us able to trust what the people are doing in the way of governance, right? Mm-hmm. And ethics are very important to my life because, as I said, if you live an ethical life, people are going to trust you. And if you're ever in a position where you're trying to get over a wall, they won't be hanging on your feet. They'll help you across the wall. Mm-hmm. So those are the three things that I think every human being should make part of his life, namely thinking and understanding. And the second one was to have put $10,000 at 9% aside at least every 6 months if they can, or every year,
right?
Or if even more frequently,
yeah.
or in a higher amount.
Yeah.
And to allow it by investing in top type of companies with patience, to allow that to give them a retirement where they don't need any pension plan, really, because that's their pension plan. And certainly live an ethical life so that people help you instead of trying to take things from you.
Stephen, I think that's a great summary. I just want to say I'm really thankful and honored that you came on the podcast and shared some wisdom with the listener. It's a real treat for me to spend time with someone like you. Your ethics, as you mentioned, principle number three, it's true in every meeting that I've been in with you, you are blunt and to the point and you cut through the bullshit and you say what needs to be said. And I think that's a really good note to end on. So thank you very much, Stephen, for being a big guest on the show. And to all the listeners, I think I may be able to convince Stephen to come on again in the future, maybe a few more times, because there's so much more to talk about. But until then, we will see you next time.